You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of April 2016 on Monocle 24. On today's show, Obama flies into the UK to wish the Queen a happy 90th and to offer his thoughts on the European project, should there continue to be one.
It's hard for me to imagine that project going well in the absence of Great Britain.
My guests Isabel Hilton and Quentin Peel will be discussing that and other stories, including history's biggest treaty signing, history's biggest compensation settlement, and history's least likely courtroom victory. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And you are welcome to the show. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, CEO of China Dialogue, and Quentin Peel, Associate Fellow with the Europe Programme at Chatham House. Welcome both back to the show. Now, first of all, if this morning's meetings, photo ops and press conferences in Riyadh all went off on time, Air Force One should presently be about 4 hours out of Stansted Airport in advance of President Barack Obama's appearance tomorrow at Queen Elizabeth II's 90th birthday lunch. It's also expected that while he's here, the President will express a view vis-a-vis the UK's upcoming referendum on membership of the EU, and that this view will be doubtless tactfully in favour of the UK staying in. Quentin, first of all, despite what the Out campaign have been saying, he's entitled to an opinion, isn't he?
I certainly think so. I mean, after all, the US has been a very close partner, supposedly in a special relationship, and an awful lot of the campaign is precisely about that special relationship, and that might be an alternative to the European Union. So that's part of it. And I think, well, I would encourage every other foreign leader in the world to say what they think. The British debate about its relationship with Europe cannot be conducted in a bubble. It affects everybody. And we've heard that from people like the IMF, and we've heard that from the OECD and the World Bank, all saying, hey, this is going to have an effect on everybody, what the British decide. It's not something that is just going to affect one little island.
Isabel, it is incredible, verging on unbearable, to think that it's still more than 2 months until we actually get to vote. Have we already, do you think, reached, indeed, possibly past that point at which, as someone once said, everything has been said, but not quite everybody has said it?
We've reached peak referendum, if you like.
Yes.
I think that's probably true, and I don't have the impression that many minds are being changed, at least amongst those who are speaking. You know, Michael Gove isn't going to change his mind, nor is Boris Johnson, nor is David Cameron. What we don't know is what's going to animate the British public, because I feel I know very little about what they think. And one thing that's lacking, which was very, very present in the Scottish referendum, was a lot of civic engagement. There were meetings, people turned out for debates in Scotland Scotland's
but
future.
But isn't that a function of, and this has just always been my observation of Britain's view of Europe as an outsider to this country, that people in Britain, they mostly don't care about the EU, and when they do think about it, they're annoyed by it. I mean, I don't know how many people you would need to stop in a given British high street before you could find one who could name their MEP.
Naming your MEP isn't the sum total of the relationship with Europe. I mean, how many people have children who travel and study abroad? How many people know people who've retired to Spain? How many people really like passport-free travel in Europe? I think people have got quite used to Europe, actually. And maybe it's the people I know. But I think certainly I would be... I mean, it's not true that I don't know... people who want to leave, but they're pretty much in a minority in the people that I know. What I really find hard to gauge is, you know, if you stop those people on the street, what do they think? I don't think any of us really know that.
Quentin, I would certainly rather have Barack Obama arguing for any case I wish to make than against it. He is a fine speaker, a thoughtful man, and a persuasive orator. But do you think there are any minds that are likely to be changed by the president making a claim on their attention?
Well, certainly the pro and anti camps are thoroughly dug in, but there is a middle ground, and the question is whether those people who are undecided in the middle ground are going to get out and vote. And there's a particular question, I think, about whether young people are going to get out and vote. It's pretty clear from the polling that one's seen that the younger generation in Britain is more for staying in the European Union than the older generation. That's a very interesting contrast to most other European countries, where it's the older people who want to have the European Union, we don't want to have a Second World War again, we want to have peace and freedom, and the younger generation who are actually a bit cynical about it all. Now, it's the opposite way around in Britain. But as we also know, young people are more disinclined to vote. Now, one thing Barack Obama's going to do when he comes here is he's going to have a big youth town hall meeting in London where he's really going to try and engage with younger people. And hey, I mean, it's not going to make a huge amount of difference. But I think the message will be, if the younger generation wants to decide its future, then it's no good just sitting on its hands. They've got to get out there and vote.
We should talk also about not just about where the president is going, i.e. here, but where he's come from, i.e. Saudi Arabia. Isabel, there's been some suggestion that a certain Freudeur has descended around this visit, that the king didn't turn up to meet him at the airport, that there was no coverage of his arrival on state television. More tellingly, I thought, White House officials said at the meeting between the two men, they, I quote, cleared the air. Now, is that worse than a full and frank exchange of views?
It's pretty hard to know, really. Clearly, there is a froideur. I mean, these are, you know, the king not only failed to turn up to meet Barack Obama, but he conspicuously welcomed other lesser mortals. When he didn't.
Indeed. So it should be noted the phrase "agreed to disagree" was also used. I mean, this is pretty hardcore stuff.
Well, I think there is a big agenda, but I don't think we should assume from that the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, you know, they're having a difficult moment, but I don't think divorce is on the cards. I mean, there's an awful lot going on in the Middle East for which the US continues to need Saudi Arabia. You know, this is an absolutely profound intelligence and security relationship that may be strained, but I very much doubt if it's going to break. I don't think that that Obama personally troubles to disguise his dislike of a lot of things about the kingdom. And, you know, who can blame him? But he knows that it's still a pillar of US Middle East policy.
Final brief thought on this one from you, Quentin. Do you get the impression the Saudis, I guess like a lot of countries around the world, are now not thinking so much about President Obama, but either President Clinton or President Trump?
I'm sure that is the case, but are they going to get a big change in American policy? I mean, what they're really annoyed about was the deal that President Obama basically has done with Iran. That is a fundamental security challenge to the Saudis, and that's why they're so upset. And as far as President Obama and a lot of other Americans are concerned, Saudi tacit support for ISIS, Daesh ISIS, is a very bad thing. This is not going to go away quickly.
Okay, well, let's move along. And without wishing to doubt the sincerity of President Obama's birthday wishes for the Queen or his desire to keep Britain in the EU, he might have had other reasons for wanting to be out of his country this week. At least 60 heads of state and government are due in New York tomorrow among representatives of 163 nations who will gather to sign the agreement on climate change, agreed to some surprise all round in Paris last December. Isabel, what's the significance of this ceremony? The agreement last December was much ballyhooed, I think largely because people were so surprised there'd been one.
Yes.
But this is supposed to be the biggest international treaty signing event ever, but other than that, does it have any meaningful significance beyond being a great photo op?
Well, it does have a significance because the quicker you sign it, the quicker you get to the point where it comes into force, you know, the quicker you sign and ratify. And if you think back to the Kyoto Protocol, it took years, and we just really don't have years to spare at this point. You know, we have mucked around for more than 20 years, and the figures are getting very alarming on concentrations of CO2. And everywhere you look, there are really quite dramatic climate impacts going on. So if you look at what the Paris Agreement aims to do. It aims to keep the temperature, global average temperature rise below 2 degrees and, if possible, below 1.5. In fact, it's on track to about 3.6, 3.7 right now. Built into the mechanism is a review, so you can come back and ratchet up your commitments. But none of that starts until this agreement comes into force. So the faster you get it done in terms of the signing and the ratification, the quicker you can get on with the job, if you like.
Quentin, it does, once it's been agreed, it now has to be signed, it then has to be ratified by individual governments. And there is some qualifier that 55 nations, which between them make up 55% of the world's emissions, the number five I recall being significant in my research. How confident are we that that process of ratification will go ahead?
I think it will. What worries me, though, is that everybody, having got to this point, will sort of relax. And what Isabel was talking about the need to actually go further, and that's perfectly clear. This is really just a first step. Are people all going to just say, oh, thank goodness we got there? I mean, this was a tremendous diplomatic achievement. Let's not underestimate it. And France, above all, did a lot of the driving for that. But, you know, they've got there. And the truth is that the US, the EU, China, everybody's got to bring their targets even further down. And they've got to get on with that very quickly, because we're going to wrap, you know, if we go over target for another 10 years, if we get to 2025 and they've done nothing, we've got far more heavy lifting to do in the future. Now, I'm just a little bit nervous that when you've had a huge effort like this and it's all culminated in a great big gangbang in New York, everybody's going to say, phew, let's go home and have a holiday.
It's the thing, it's the mistaking the appearance of having solved the problem for actually solving the problem. Isabel, I was wondering, though, and without wishing to sound like some sort of crazed neoliberal economic rationalist pull up the ladder crank, because I'm really not, is there an argument that any treaty like this will ultimately be superseded, overhauled, rendered redundant by the economic appeal of renewable energy, that the market will sort it out on its own? Last year, global investment in renewable energy was more than twice what was spent on fossil fuel infrastructure.
Sure, but that happens partly as a result of this, you know, long effort to get climate change onto
the agreement
the serious
provides
agendas.
The impetus to
well,
invest.
Precisely, you know, the kind of the effort of Copenhagen, which failed, but then the kind of the big build-up, and Quentin's absolutely right. The French were completely fabulous in this, and for 2 years they thought very hard about how you build enough momentum into a process to produce an agreement. People have been thinking about how, once the agreement is in place, how you keep that momentum going. And the kind of the jamboree in New York is part of that. It's obviously not sufficient. But the tipping point, the sense of tipping point, is exactly as you say, that I think maybe 5 years ago we would have said any developing country is going to go the heavy carbon route because it's cheaper. It no longer is cheaper. You know, it's not uncomplicated to, you know, build an emerging economy on wind and solar. But people understand a number of things. They understand the cost, the local costs of coal, which are not to do with the price of coal. They're to do with human health, water, all those things, air quality, one of the big drivers in China. But also, you know, renewables are at par with fossil fuels in a lot of countries now. So it makes no sense to develop a 19th century economy when you can develop a 21st century economy.
Quentin, are there grounds for concern that, I mean, as we've obviously been discussing, President Obama will not be at the ceremony tomorrow because he'll be here, but the two biggest emitters, and obviously the two crucial powers here, are the United States and China. Neither is sending their top guy tomorrow. John Kerry for the US, Vice Premier Zhang Zhaoli for China. Are they trying to keep one foot out the door, both those two countries?
They've got a big challenge ahead of them. I'm not sure that we should read too much into that symbolism. I think that they don't want this to fail. They will look bad if this fails. And I think the point Isabel's just made, what is fascinating here is how much China has shifted in a way that China has realised that polluting its own people is not a very clever idea. And pollution does tend to start at home and then no doubt goes abroad as well. So I think that there has been a very real change of mindset that happened in Paris, and that's what this represents.
On that final thought, Isabel, how crucial do you think that has been for that shift by China that Quentin has mentioned? Because, I mean, I haven't set foot in Beijing for, God, 2001, 15 years. And 15 years ago, at the end of a day out in Beijing, you could scrape it off your forehead. And I don't imagine the atmosphere has improved. And we have seen, you know, in the last couple of years, you know, the rationing of traffic, rationing of petrol, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, trying to make the air in the city breathable. It's axiomatic that the one thing that the Chinese Communist Party desires above all other things is stability. Had they got to the point where they thought this could actually be a threat, this could result in actual widespread unrest if people can't breathe when they go outside, and that's what shifted their thinking?
Environmental issues have already been the cause of widespread unrest in China. They are the cause of many of the approximately 100,000 major incidents that the Chinese admit to every year. So yes, and actually your great shiny capital, if you're Xi Jinping and your message to the people is we're making China great and your capital is so polluted that nobody wants to live in it, you know, that's a real failure. It's a real loss of face. The other driver is that, you know, as the market for steel collapses, as all the heavy industries are really outdated very quickly in China, what's the next big driver of the Chinese economy? It has to be a higher value technology. What are the higher value technologies of the future? They're low carbon technologies. So China actually has a profound economic interest in the success of an agreement to constrain carbon emissions, because it's going to be the supplier of those goods.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Isabel Hilton and Quentin Peel. Coming up next, Anders Behring Breivik gets his day in court.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the program that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Isabel Hilton and Quentin Peel. Now, let's look now at Norway. It's probably fair to say that the global reaction when narcissistic racist mass murderer Anders Behring Breivik launched a lawsuit over the conditions of his captivity was one of bemusement. Since a Norwegian court upheld some of Breivik's complaint yesterday, that response has escalated to outright bafflement. In many countries, Breivik would already be dead. In no countries would he be missed. But is there something admirable about Norway's treatment of him? Quentin, I'll ask you first. Norwegian prisons have actually been the focus of a lot of attention because of Breivik's captivity. They are clearly among the world's more comfortable. What kind of life does the state, any state, owe someone like Anders Behring Breivik after he's done what he's done?
I don't think they owe him a very good quality of life at all. Of course, I mean, the primary punishment is to be deprived of one's freedom. But I find it incredibly difficult to feel much sympathy for him standing on his human rights, that solitary confinement is something that that was a violation of his human rights.
It also does, I thought, rather presuppose that anybody would seek his company.
It's so difficult. I mean, this is a man who killed 77 people, most of them young people who he shot one by one with single shots to the head. This man showed absolutely no respect for the human condition at all. Now, having said that, clearly you can't torture him. That would be utterly wrong. And I think that things like that. But it is extraordinary to see a system bending it so far over. He was held in solitary confinement for this period with three rooms, with computer games.
I have literally stayed in many worse hotels.
Indeed, yes, with very much less than one room. So I find it incredibly difficult to see that one should be more generous.
But is it arguable, Isabel, leaving aside the obvious about Breivik, which is that he is a terrible and ridiculous man, and he is, you know, a chronic attention seeker, epically self-pitying, all of that sort of stuff. Does Norway have a point, though, even in as much that, and it's a very good argument, I think, against torture and against execution, that it is bad for the people who are obliged to carry it out on the state's behalf, that you are sparing the employees of your own nation from having to do this?
I think that one of the most telling reactions to this was actually one of the survivors who said, and you have to admire this, that the best way to deal with this kind of extremism is to maintain your morality and your standards of justice. Now, of course, it sticks in everybody's throat when someone quite as loathsome as Breivik gets a victory of any kind. But actually, you know, Norway does uphold these values, not only in Norway, but internationally. And if it's upholding the premises of the European Convention on Human Rights, it has to. Now, whether we would regard this as torture is another issue. But I think what the judge took into consideration was the fact that he was being treated as, you know, his treatment fell below the standards, if you like, of Norwegian prisons in the strip churches, the waking up in the middle of the night and the solitary confinement, and that was in contravention of the convention. Now, if you were to say to the average Norwegian, you know, does he deserve a better deal? Clearly they'd say no. But if you were to say to the average Norwegian, are you happy that Norway is in contravention of the convention, they'd probably say no too. It is difficult, but actually, you know, the hard thing, you know, it's the worst cases that test these principles.
And you shouldn't, as the old saying has it, hard cases tend to make bad laws. Quentin, though it does, as Isabel says, stick in the craw that somebody like Breivik should be provided with a lifetime's relative comfort by the state he attacked, as a general principle, does Norway have it right? Their statistics seem to suggest so. Though their prisons are comfortable by the standards of prisons, most people don't come back to them. They seem to be actually very good at rehabilitating people. Do too many countries think of prison as something that should be, or do they think about prisoners, I guess, emotionally and vindictively rather than calmly and practically?
I think that many of us get our prison systems wrong. I think it's at the other end of the scale that they're really wrong, where petty offenders, small offenders are thrown into a pretty unpleasant prison environment where there are drugs around, where they form gangs again.
This is when Douglas Hurd, as Home Secretary, said prison was an expensive way of making bad people worse.
Yes, absolutely. Now, Breivik is obviously completely at the far end of the scale on that. This is the decision of one judge. The state has not yet decided whether they're going to appeal against this or not. They were certainly quite surprised and taken aback that what they thought was still pretty reasonable treatment has been rejected. And so I think that it's not the final say on it. But I think prison systems, the fact that Norway is doing well says a lot about Norwegian society as much as it does about the prison system. And it may be that Norway is not sending the sort of petty offenders to jail, or is actually getting them out of prison pretty quickly, that in a country like the UK or the US, far more are going to jail.
I think Norway does have a 20-year problem with Breivik, in that this man will go on trying to get attention, whatever the Norwegian state does. So, you know, he'll go on hunger strike. He'll bring another case, and that I think is going to be a continuing headache for Norway. Well, what do you do with someone like Breivik?
Well, right there, I think, is the issue. I mean, we spoke on the Daily last night to our correspondent in Oslo, and also to a Norwegian lawyer who made all the points in defence of their country's liberal justice system, but both said that what most Norwegians think about Breivik is they just don't want to hear from him or about him
ever again.
And that is the difficulty, that you know, if every day in court gives this tiresome clown another platform. Finally tonight, though, and continuing with the theme of courtroom triumphs by perhaps unlikely plaintiffs, Russia has had quite the result in the Netherlands. Back in 2014, the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague ruled that Russia owed the shareholders of defunct oil company Yukos the not inconsequential sum of $50 billion, the largest such compensation settlement in history. The Hague District Court has now ruled that the PCA had no jurisdiction. Quentin, this seems to me at least like an extremely technical decision, that Russia breached an energy charter originally that it did sign, but Russia's defence was that they never quite got around to ratifying it, and they're off the hook in that regard.
Yeah, it does seem very technical, and I don't think it's over by any means. But it is quite a victory for Russia to get this huge compensation
20% of their national budget.
Yeah, indeed, or $50 billion. I mean, it compares with what's about $130 billion a year they get from oil revenues, so $50 billion would have been a huge whack of an annual oil revenue. Now, having said that, this arbitration case is going on a whole string of other countries, So there's a real possibility that they're going to find another court that may, perhaps at a lower level, give it back. The trouble is that the history of Yukos really stinks. The whole way that it was seized, but I suspect also the way that it was built up. Nobody's got entirely clean hands in this game. And this is part of the tragedy, really, of post-Soviet Russia, that you have a rush to the worst sort of robber capitalism that has actually not cleaned up the country. It's still riddled with corruption, both within the government and in the private sector. And I think we're going to see cases like this coming to our courts for decades to come.
Yukos being one of the companies, of course, that became fantastically wealthy very, very quickly in that giddy period that you were mentioning there, Quentin, after the Soviet Union collapsed and Russia attempted to embrace capitalism.
Not least because, actually, it must be credited to Mikhail Khodorkovsky and some of his managers, they brought in really quite good management techniques. They turned around these dreadfully inefficient but very oil wealthy companies and turned them into quite an efficient operation.
But the original case that led to this settlement in the first place, Isabel, was that the breakup of Yukos was politically motivated. It kind of was, wasn't it?
Well, I think undoubtedly. And I think even were such a case to go against Russia, the chances of getting the money would be rather slender. To the perfectly fair point that Quentin makes, that this will go on and on, I did notice that the Russians indeed are threatening to bring up exactly that question of how Yukos was run and tax not paid. And, you know, this is a boondoggle, which in the end I think will benefit only the lawyers.
Well, Russia rather wonderfully is also now claiming, Quentin, that the original judgment against them for breaking Yukos up for political reasons was itself politically motivated.
Yes, well, I mean, the truth is that Mr. Putin and his propaganda chiefs are very clever at the way they use information, and they create just enough ambiguity, just enough doubt in people's minds to think maybe they have got something there. And they've got away with this one for the time being.
This was the team that called the Panama Papers a plot against Russia.
I think it's safe to say it may be some time before we hear the end of this one. Isabel Hilton and Quentin Peel, we will have to leave it there. Thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all for today's edition of the show. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maria Granina. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's more music next at 1900. It's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. We'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.